Welcome to this week's Coffee with Digital Trailblazers. This is our 85th episode. It's kind of amazing that we're going strong, continuing to come up with different topics and new angles for everybody leading digital transformation in their organizations. I'm Isaac Sokolik. I lead a company called Star CIO, and we're just going to give everybody a few minutes to join. Get our quorum here of people who are listening. It's been, I would say, an interesting week. Last week of June is always, you know, we had a graduation in our family that we're excited and psyched about. My younger one finishing his eighth grade, moving up into the high school years. We have a full house in my house at this point with everybody home. So it's been fun, a fun week. I am having a little bit of a celebration this week. I use this app called the Amazon app, and it's pretty good at reminding you of the photos that you took on the same day last year. And I never even realized this, that author copies of Driving Digital came on, I think it was June 22nd, and this would have been 2017. And the author copies of Digital Trailblazer came on June 23rd, that would have been 2022. So I'm celebrating the 2 year and the 7 year anniversary of my books. Super excited around that. If you have not read my books, I did leave some links in the comments around being able to access them. I am still hoping that Digital Trailblazer will become a bestseller one day. And it continues to sell, continue to get interest in people giving me comments about it. So thank you for that. I also left you some comments from our other Digital Trailblazers here who join me regularly. Congratulations to Martin Davis, who has joined the board. Martin, when you first speak up, tell us a little bit about that. And Joanne, who has spoken here a few times about the five E's of leading transformation. She has a great blog post around that published this week. I left you links to both of those in the comments. And then I left you links to some of my latest writing that came out this week. So we are all lifelong learners here. I have my Digital Trailblazer community that I'll be announcing to everybody here in just a few weeks. That's a core goal of mine, is to continue to facilitate networking, learning, leadership training for everybody. And you'll hear about that announcement in about a couple of weeks for the Digital Trailblazer community. Today, we have an exciting conversation, Agile Innovation, leading innovation labs from POC to production. We actually covered this May of last year a little bit. We talked about different forms of organizing around organizing ourselves around driving innovation and doing experimentation. Roman brought this up at a previous or more recent conversation, said, I really want to talk about how do we make innovation labs successful? How do we guide them? How do we help them take something that worked in the lab and bringing it into production? And that's what we're going to cover today. So Roman, I'm going to give you first time to have a conversation around this. I'm really interested. I did some writing more recently about machine learning and AI. There's always a low percentage of the experiments that data science teams and by extension innovation teams go from what they're experimenting on and the ability to take that to pilot and then take it to production. And part of that is the nature of innovation in itself, right? You have to allow for experimenting to learn. Not everything that you experiment with is going to lead to a pilot or production. But anybody who is involved with investing and driving value and ROI off of innovation labs has to be concerned if you have a very low percentage of experiments that are getting into production. So let's kick this off with a conversation, Roman, and then we'll have everybody else join in. What are some of the barriers that prevent AI and other innovations from going from successful POC to production pilots? Thank you, Roman, for suggesting the topic.
Okay. So before I answer that question, I just want to spend a moment and maybe set some context for the listeners around three different organizational models around innovation. So there's, just so that we have that context, one is the typical research and development lab. These are people who are developing new products for the company, generally focused on technical feasibility. The second organizational model is around corporate venture capital teams within a corporation. They invest in or acquire promising companies, but they need access to capital, really. And then the third group is what I call the corporate innovation lab. And they can be either an external group separate from the core business, or sometimes they can be an internal group within the business. But their mission is generally to create disruptive new solutions before the competitors do. And they can be any set of innovation things. They can be around business models. They can be around technologies. They can be around customer-centric solutions, things like that. So today I'm hoping to really stay focused on the corporate innovation labs, although I do know that lots of companies will try to mash those three things together in various combinations or move things around a little bit in there. So not one size fits all. When it comes to corporate innovation labs, and especially technologies like AI, ML, and things like that, I've always looked at it in terms of making sure that that lab or that group is organized in such a way where they don't fall into what I guess Joanne would call the non-value proposition. So oftentimes innovation labs get obsessed with things we can do versus things we should do. And then the second thing they often get tied into is perpetual proof of concepts or pilots, and they never really move anything to production. So let's take your question again about AI ML, and what were you thinking in terms of that? Like moving it to a production environment or how that happens? Or
Well, part of it is what you're saying, can versus should do. And that's happening significantly in the ML AI space because it's just the nature of how the technologies are evolving so quickly. That's leading to perpetual POCs. And, you know, I do think data science is a science. So there's a little bit of we're going to try a model and see if it works, or we're going to try a model and see if we have sufficient data to make it work. So there is definitely a lot of experimentation on the data science side before you even have something worthy of being production ready. But then there's all the internal factors, right? Taking a model and connecting it to workflow. It's taking a model and plugging it into an environment where people make decisions. It's whether you're in fact modeling decisions that that are valuable to have all this analytics and data and prediction around it. It's the internal reactions, the change management reactions that go into it. So those are some of the things that I was thinking of when I put that question out.
Okay. So when I ran an innovation lab early on, and it was a pleasure to do that, it was really a great opportunity. We were experimenting with kind of the beginnings of AI ML, not generative AI, but just machine learning and how we could use that. Oftentimes we fell into it more than we actually tried to get into it. I'll give you an example. We had within the insurance company that I was with, we had a motor club. And one of the president of the motor club wanted to know if there was a way to, from a cell phone, determine whether or not one of their customers was having a issue with their cars. You know, were they having a flat tire? Were they stranded on the road? Things like that. Could we know ahead of time before they actually call? Now, aside from the creepiness of that application, it was interesting that at the time we were sitting there going, well, you know, the cell phones have about 16, 17 different sensors on them. Which ones can we program? And we started writing code in terms of if, then, else kinds of rules. And then we partnered with a university that was getting into a lot of AI work. And their students just took a approach of creating a learning model on the cell phone that, and they would drive around and they would simulate different kinds of road emergencies, one of which made us really nervous, which was like they simulated a flat tire on an open road. And we were like, oh, please don't do this. But okay. They did it anyway, and they were able to capture from that information which of the 16 sensors was the most reliable to be able to tell you whether or not you were having some kind of road emergency. And, you know, interestingly enough, it wasn't, you know, the camera, and it wasn't, you know, the gyroscope, and it wasn't a bunch of other sensors. It was actually the microphone that, so, I mean, talk about adding to the creepiness level. So we were able to create an app that would, you know, tell us whether or not somebody was having a road emergency based on the swishing car noise that was going past you.
Wow. That's I think, a great example of where, you know, you got to do a little bit of experimenting with the solution to see whether or not what you're developing is going to end up providing some value. I want to give everybody else a chance to chime in here. Martin, your thoughts on Innovation Labs?
Well, I think the first and the important thing we need to be clear on is a bit of a definition here. So people often confuse innovation and invention. So invention is creating something new, creating a cure for cancer, creating a new drug, creating an entirely new way of doing things or something like that. Innovation is often about using something that already exists, maybe in a different country, and maybe in a different company, maybe being used in a different way, and using it within your company. So an innovation lab is often going to be looking at comparative things that it can reuse in a different way or reuse within your company. So that's important, because people often get those two confused and think you're creating an innovation lab, they're going to be your mad scientists going off and creating stuff. Not necessarily. They are going to be looking at how you can improve your company. Yeah, and AI and ML is a good example. But let's not just get stuck in the kind of AI and ML kind of bucket. This could be reusing a different approach to doing your development. It could be using tools that are used in the, I don't know, the airline industry, and repurposing them to use them in the retail environment. Yeah, things like that. It is, how do you actually improve the way you're doing business? How can you innovate? And if you think about Amazon with the stores without having to check out at the store. Yeah, that's a proof of concept, and actually more production now. But that came from the experiments in an innovation lab about how can we capture what things are being picked up by people and actually charge them automatically. So those are just examples. It is, none of that technology, or majority of that technology in the Amazon example, is new. But putting a whole load of that technology together in a certain way, plus the appropriate intelligence around it in order to bring it together to a complete solution, that's innovation. So I just wanted to kind of put that out there, some definitions and clarity. And by the way, thank you for mentioning I joined the board of directors of CAA Atlantic. CAA, like AAA, is the road service organization, but also insurance and travel and other stuff like that as well. So as Roman mentioned, the roadside assistance side of things, it's quite appropriate, really.
Thank you, Martin. You know, I think particularly when you start setting up the governance and the structure around an innovation lab, I think it's important to highlight that. It's very easy for the folks joining the innovation lab not to recognize the difference between invention and innovation. So that's a good recipe for success. Joanne, your thoughts on setting up innovation labs for success and bring more POCs to production?
Well, good morning and happy early Canada Day, or July 4th, to everybody who's on the call that may be in North America and celebrating those patriotic holidays, as it were. I looked at this from the perspective of, the way the question was asked, what's a barrier that puts up it takes a POC that's very successful in an innovation lab and stops it from getting into production. So from that perspective, there's a few different ones. And then I have a bit of an anecdotal story to tell, which happened in the last couple of weeks. So one of the barriers is a lack of a clear business objective. And that goes to not only Martin's definition issue of invention versus innovation. And I'm very much like-minded in that respect. But the other barriers to entry can also be data quality and availability, scalability. You know, there's like four or five different ones that can really get in your way and require you to pre-plan those eventualities. And so one of the first things is having the innovation lab really go through the ideation, planning, and operational sort of stages, the same way as you would do in strategic planning, whether you're an IT leader or a business leader leading transformation. And so from that perspective, the story goes, so one of my clients, they were very early on in AI and developed a very cool proof of concept that was predominantly used for predicting machine failure. And it was a typical OEE kind of capability, and they had great success in the innovation lab. They got the first level pass to start moving it into production, but they hit two obstacles, one of which was data quality, which they didn't realize upfront that their data that they used in the innovation lab should have been synthetic or synthesized in some way to make it more accurate. They just took what they had available, and it was very poor data quality. And the other was that the primary people who would be using this AI would be maintenance staff and, to a certain extent, process and control engineers. Well, the issue became nobody wanted to really take advantage of it, not only because of the poor quality, but because the way those groups of personas or people would work on the shop floor would be antithetic to the way the application was designed. So this is a perfect instance of where human-centered design comes into play, why I recommend it to almost all of my clients, and why I think it's really effective to show the value from all the different sort of perspectives that one needs for a digital trailblazer to assume. So in this case, we sent them down to the shop floor. We told them to hang out with everybody who was going to be using this AI capability and to really begin to understand what their issues would be, not only empathizing with the users on a regular basis and using design thinking methods and human-centered design, but also to look at where they got their data, why it was poor quality, and what would have to be done to improve the quality of the data. Also to allay their and assuage their fears that this new AI application would replace them, because they really weren't going to be replaced. They were trying to be augmented, if you will, with this new capability. So long story short, it turned out that the brainstorming session with the staff that would be involved was they needed to retweak not only the data flows that would come into the models that were being trained for the AI, but to really generate the solution in collaboration with actual day-to-day. And at the end of it, the maintenance folk, the process and control engineers, everybody ended up having a completely different view. And this is now, in the past 3 weeks, been spread to four different facilities. So once it got moved into production, based on a collaborative effort, so take the innovation lab and then expand its mandate to be able to bring people in from day-to-day operations, they had a huge success. And now it's going to be spread probably into 45 of their facilities over the next year. So this is the problem, the barrier, how to get past it, and how to use different tactics and different types of thinking to really get the buy-in and really get the innovation lab to be a stellar kind of showcase within the organization.
Let's bring John in, and then I have some thoughts around this. Go ahead, John.
Thanks, Isaac, and yeah, thanks for having me up here. And for me, like, a POC can be successful even if it doesn't go into production. Like, if you get really good learnings out of it, and you decide that, like, the information I learned makes, you know, allows me to make a really good decision in the future, like, that's a successful POC, right? And so a lot of times we think that POCs, like, they're only successful if we are able to take that code and stick it in production. And I actually almost would recommend considering going the other way, which is, like, you should do POCs to get really good learnings, to learn how to use technology. I agree, most of the ones that fail, are they fail because the way they're set up out of the gate. I think I heard a lot of reasons. I completely agree with them. The one additional reason I heard is a lot of times people just don't know how to use, how to apply new technology. And since they don't know how to apply the technology, they hear about other people using it. And so they have to do iterations in POCs to try to figure out how they might use it to solve their business problems. The other thing I was going to say is that once the reason that POCs are able to happen for a low cost is let's be honest, they have a lot of shortcuts, right? And so a lot of times you're putting code in production that's not fully designed, it's not fully tested. It may have taken some shortcuts. And so like a lot of times people say, well, I invested in this POC or this pilot, but like, why can't I just put this in production and run it in production? And the thing I always say is that, maybe you can, but like you should look to see what you have and to see if it's safe to run in production, or should you just take the learning from that and like write down everything that went well, everything went bad, and then just rebuild it from scratch. And that's a lot of times I found that just sometimes taking something that was built with a bunch of corners and trying to put that in production can be more work than just taking your learnings and starting from a fresh slate and going on.
Thanks, John, for that. You know, as I'm listening to everybody talk about, you know, what an innovation lab is or isn't, and how to structure it, you know, I'm thinking that maybe the word lab is part of the issue. You know, we have this sort of picture that comes with a lab that it's in its own room and it's boxed in, and maybe you don't know what's happening inside the lab. They're sort of living in their own world, right? It's their own ecosystem. And, you know, the people you put inside the lab are maybe the smartest people, the most innovative people, the people who are able to run experiments really well. But the problems you're homing in on, the lab is not reflecting on the outside world, right? They're not understanding what customers need, what the organization wants out of innovation from a value perspective. So, you know, Joanne's recommendation that you should put anything in the ideation anything in the lab through its own ideation process makes total sense to me, and break that front end down so they're focused on things that, if materialized, do deliver value. And then on the back end, which is really where I see a lot of the issues, is the teams that have to productionalize that innovation, whether it's the engineers who have to integrate it into a workflow, the end users who have to accept it as a new way of working, there's a almost an internal reaction of not invented here just by the fact that it was built inside a lab and not a real world scenario. And now a lot of work to get them to understand what was built, what its value was, how to use it, how to integrate it, whether it's production ready, to John's point. Those are some of the barriers that I see as soon as you start calling it a lab. And I know why a lot of enterprises choose to do this. If they want innovation coming out of their business teams, they're often too focused on operations. They don't have enough time to do it from an operational perspective. They're looking at incremental, non-disruptive type of innovation. So they create this innovation lab to think outside of the box, to be have enough time to really experiment and learn and try things out. But then they focus on the wrong things sometimes. They don't have an understanding of customer and design thinking, and then they can't bring it into production because the teams they need to interface with to succeed doing that are putting up that not invented here syndrome. Roman, I'm going to bring it back to you. what are some solutions to this? Is the word lab wrong, or do we have to have different processes around the lab to make it more successful?
Well, the way I look at it is labs or innovation labs tend to go through a maturity cycle. And I think at the bottom of that maturity cycle is just a innovation lab that spends its time doing coordination and curation of innovative ideas around the company. You know, they're going to collect, categorize, prioritize any ideas, and then report out. So that's, I guess, the basic lowest level of maturity for an innovation lab. The next one, next step up, is where they start doing facilitation of innovation, which is what Joanne brought up with things like actually running human-centered design or design sprints and running them for different business units, maybe doing partnerships within the organization or with other organizations like startups or universities. And then the third level of maturity is where we kind of started today, which is the idea of doing proof of concepts or market tests or even pilots. And then the last level, which, you know, is really the tough one, is can that lab be used as a way of pushing and transforming the organization into a more innovative organization? And, you know, I've had the pleasure of actually going through all four of those phases, each of which has its own challenges. And you guys are right. When, you know, you talk about POCs and market tests, you're at that third level. You need a development team inside that lab. And that development team needs to understand what the company's data is, you know, what they can do, what they can't do with the data. They need to understand the basics of human-centered design and either customer or employee experience. And you hit it right on the nail there. They need to fix that not invented here mentality where, you know, that's one of the reasons you don't want to bring outside consultants in maybe to do a lot of this POC work, because they're going to get into data quality issues and not using the right technical stack and not using the right tools that make it easy to move into production if you want to do that. So anyway, those are my four levels of maturity: curation, facilitation, and partnerships. The third one is around doing those market tests and developing solutions that can go to production. And then the last one is actually transforming the organizations into more, you know, what I call innovation within the organizational complex, not where you have to go to a lab at all.
I have a question, Roman.
Yeah.
What term do you use when the innovation lab becomes so successful that intrapreneurship becomes entrepreneurship and you spin off that lab into a separate company or a startup of its own?
Oh, and that's one of the things we did was in our organizational model, we separated the concept of the innovation lab from a corporate venture capital kind of organization. So when that was so successful that you wanted to create your own business unit, it went over to Strategic Ventures. That's what the organization was called. And they had the know-how and the capital and the, you know, the techniques to do everything from building a startup to partnering and absorbing the startup to doing a merger and acquisition. They had all of the right legal investment people and the money, which an innovation lab generally doesn't have access to huge amounts of capital. So that's how we handled it. It was a kind of a handoff to another organization called Strategic Ventures.
To me, that's the highest level of the innovation lab. That's the goal to strive for.
Yeah, it could be. Again, our goal in our innovation lab, our highest level was trying to make the rest of the corporation innovative so that we could shut down the lab, in effect. It was the planned obsolescence, eventually, of making the company innovative enough so you don't need a lab.
Roman, I think that's a really good point. It really goes back to however, you know, whatever formulated the idea around this, the lab itself, and having a long-term vision around it, and you know, maybe that long-term vision is stated up front. Hey, we want to, you know, we want to engineer new products. We want to spin off business units around it. A lot of universities have that capability. They're not going to go bring an innovation to market. And when they have something that looks successful, they do a spinoff and a partnership around that. Sometimes it's just to bring innovation capabilities into the organization, right? Have a team lead the way. And hopefully the goal is to shut down innovation as a separate lab and bring that capability back to the business units once there's a methodology in place. Yeah. Sort of the other extreme. Martin, I saw you went off mute, so I want you to contribute here, and then I'll take my break after that.
Yeah, I was just gonna throw in a contrary point of view. And if you look back to what happened in the early days of digital, and I think Gartner came up with the term bimodal IT. And this, groan going out around the place. And what actually happened was, yeah, you had kind of a digital innovation group that was created, off doing its own thing, thinking, isn't this wonderful? And the rest of the organization carrying on in parallel. And the digital stuff kind of started to grow, and the existing organization kind of carried on along. And unlike in kind of Roman's example, where the kind of innovation became kind of all-encompassing, what happened in so many companies was the digital piece kind of did its own thing. The existing organization didn't change. And you had this fractured organization where the two pieces didn't meld well together. And that whole kind of bimodal IT kind of imploded. So I just wanted to kind of throw that out there quickly. I know you're going to take your break, but I just it's kind of an interesting kind of corollary to what Roman just came up with.
Yeah, no. So let's return to this when we get back, because, you know, name of bimodal IT aside, it is a problem, right? It goes back to what happens when you can't bring innovation capabilities back into your operating and business units, and it is a self-contained island, and they start going off in a completely separate direction from the current operating model. And now you're paying for two operating models, and you have one group that's, you know, working on, you know, legacy ways of doing things, another group creating a whole new operating model. I mean, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? You know, at what point does the organizational leadership have to challenge this and say, we need to bring these two things together sooner rather than having, like Gartner described, which I think was a self-proclaimed promise, we're going to end up in two modes in two business operations because of that. I think that's something that you want to prevent and find the right times to bring them together. So let's carry that conversation when we come back from the break. I want to welcome everybody to the Coffee with Digital Trailblazers. We meet every week here at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, talking about different issues facing those leading digital transformation initiatives in their organizations. Today, we're talking about innovation and innovation labs. I have my next two sessions listed in the about section of this page on June 28th next week. That's this week. Holy cow, I'm losing track. I only have one announcement. So for those of you who want to give me some ideas, I'll be announcing July next week. But we have July 5th next week, lifelong learning, fun and growth-oriented activities for digital trailblazers. So that will be next week. And I promise I will have July's schedule out early next week. I left everybody a whole ton of links in the comments to this week. An article written by Joanne, very worth reading, about the 5 E's of leading transformation. An announcement from Martin about his new board membership. 3 of my articles that I've written. I'm celebrating this week my anniversary of publishing 2 books, Driving Digital and Digital Trailblazer. If you've not read those books, I'm more than welcome for you to pick up a copy and read them. And as I said, I am launching, soft launching the Digital Trailblazer community this summer. My son and I have been working on this together for the last month. We're just about ready to alpha launch it. And if you want a preview invitation to it, if you have not done this already, please visit starcio.com. Coffee. You'll join the 1.0 version of the community, and I've got a whole ton of new capabilities I'm launching with 2.0. So thank you for doing that. So let's revisit this, guys, and ladies, and everybody who's listening, anybody who wants to join us up on stage, right? This idea of an innovation lab. We do this because we want to accelerate digital innovations that might be disruptive, or we want to bring in capabilities that are maybe outside of our organization, but we don't want to end up with two operating models, and we don't want to end up in a situation where we're focused on the wrong things. We're focused on all the shiny objects. We build innovations that nobody is willing to absorb and productionalize or start using in their operations. So many things that can go wrong in setting up this lab. It almost makes me wonder if this is a bad idea to begin with, even more than just calling it a lab. Maybe that just segregating innovation is a thing of the past, something Martin is almost suggesting, saying, you know, we have to do this in digital to create an accelerant. Maybe we don't need this anymore. So I'll just throw that out there for all of us to contemplate. I'm going to give the floor to John first for you to work with. You've seen some of this in your clients and your work, what's worked internationally and different not worked internationally. What are some models that you've seen work before?
Well, so models that I've seen work well are the more that you spend time up front trying to figure out like what information you want to get, and having guardrails on like okay, on a specific project, like what is success? Like what information are we trying to get? Like what do we have to find out? What do we have to prove that works? What do we have to prove that doesn't work? And like the thing that to me is success is if you get that innovation team working on the thing that's the highest business value for the company or the people that need its help. Like if they're doing experiments on stuff that don't benefit anybody, that doesn't help out. But if the rest of the team, they're interested in using some different technologies and they want to know the one that's most feasible, that's something that like if that's the highest priority for the rest of the organization, let's get that one over to the innovation team. And let's get out specific experiments for them to test out to see which you know path is the most successful for them. And so that's why I think the more that you can really lay out what you're doing as an experiment, like what you're trying to find out, like what is success and what information do I have to have, the more that they're going to be able to return on investment to the entire company.
Joanne, I know you went off mute. Go ahead.
I think one of the things that needs to happen to prevent the bimodal is a very core piece of the charter of the innovation group, and I call it group, because instead of just doing a single use case of why you want to do the experiments, to John's point, and they are experiments, is to have a methodology in place of how you're going to approach it. Like how many sources of removing non-valuable tasks are there? How many opportunities do you have to create value for your supply chain, for your customer chain? In other words, the whole ecosystem around you. What is it going to bring you short-term, mid-term, and long-term? On the basis that you will be successful by doing them. And then once you have that sort of framework in place, you can break it into the various experimental sets and also get deeper into what kind of information are you trying to glean? Is it purely technology or are there other attributes that you're looking for at the same time? Because it may not be the most cutting edge technology, but it may have tremendous business value in ways that you didn't previously think of.
Yeah, it's funny. Before Roman jumps in here, just before you started speaking, I wrote in my notes, communicate and evolve the charter and vision. And, you know, I think you need to do that anytime you're setting up an organizational model of some kind, you know, or creating an enterprise-wide process. If I'm going to create multidisciplinary teams, people need to understand why, what's the structure, what's the benefit, what are people's roles and responsibilities. If you're going to start rolling out agile or design thinking or setting up a more extended service desk, all those require communicating and defining a charter and vision around it and continuing to evolve that. Part of that needs to include what people outside of those environments, what do they need to learn and glean from it, and what are their responsibilities? So if I'm setting up an innovation lab, and if I'm going to call it that or something different, I want to make sure that my business unit GMs understand what their responsibility is around supporting that innovation lab, or the IT team, or the data science team, or the development team, or the IT operations teams, and being able to take and partner with the innovation labs when they have something that's production ready. Go ahead, Roman.
So I was going to say, you know, innovation labs, from my experience, I've had a chance to talk to a lot of different companies. Many of them fail, and it's probably just because they don't really know what they're about, what their charter is. So that's spot on. The other things I wanted to mention, though, was John brought up the idea of, you know, POCs don't necessarily need to be successful, and that's absolutely true, but you need to have some way of having those learnings captured and communicated to the rest of the organization. I'll give an example. Early on, our lab worked with Amazon when they first came out with the, with the Alexa tool. So we had written early on an Alexa skill for insurance. Now, I will tell you that nobody used that. Once it went to POC and market test, nobody used it. It was just a real, you know, bummer in terms of usage. However, the team that worked on it learned so much about natural language processing that when it came time to bring advanced chatbots into the call center, those people were able to quickly transition and help bring up incredible capabilities in our call center in terms of AI chatbots and things that you could do there. So if you can capture those learnings and the people are still there, that's the important part of a failure. The second thing is you can also be your worst enemy in terms of success. We had a number of market tests that went very well, and then your, you know, business unit GM or vice president says to you, now I want to go roll this out countrywide or across the globe. How fast can you do that? And you say, well, you know, my team's not really the right team to do that. And so you wind up, and we solve this problem kind of accidentally by putting the innovation group inside of IT architecture. And because they were part of architecture, not only did they know what the new technologies were that were coming down in the door and things like that, and what was approved and what wasn't, but we knew what the tech stack was. We knew what the data was that we could and couldn't use. We knew all of those things. So transitioning it to the appropriate production team got rid of a lot of that not invented here mentality, because, you know, they were using the right stack. They knew, you know, which stack to use. So even though the company used multiple tech stacks, we knew that marketing used, you know, the Microsoft one, and the claims people used something different. You know, they used the Java stack. And so it was ready for them to go. And they looked like success stories, not so much us.
I think I'm picking up another word there, Roman, and that's success stories, or defining success as part of your charter. You know, even if part of your charter is to experiment and learn from it, as you're suggesting and John suggested earlier, you know, learning in by itself only delivers values when the learning gets applied in some fashion downstream, whether it's a better decision or around a technology. So I think the learning objectives of an innovation lab has to be part of that charter, and the success criteria around learning or delivering production or changing culture, that needs to be qualified and ideally quantified for people. Go ahead, Martin. I do have a follow-up question for everyone, but I want to hear Martin first.
I was just going to say, it's important to define these things up front. Yeah, define how you're going to learn from what you're experimenting with, you're innovating with, what your goals and objectives are. And those, as you said, may be twofold. They may be the original thing was to create a product, to create a new way of working in the company, but to learn from doing it. That, yes, they may have dual objectives. But then on top of that, is trying to define how you operationalize it afterwards. And the people in an innovation lab are usually entirely the wrong people to try and operationalize something like that. So working out how it gets from the innovation lab to the rest of the company is incredibly important. And yeah, having that thought through, you know, how you transition it. It's the same way if you're developing a new piece of software. How do you transition that from the development team to production and to the operationalized side of things? It's that same type of SDLC process. You need to think of it, and how do you do that with the innovation lab? And it may involve additional steps you normally take, because it may be new technology or new ways of doing things that the company is not used to. So you need to think it through carefully in order to have that successful transition.
Thank you, Martin. I want to throw out this last question so we have enough time to cover it. We've been talking about the structure, success, chartering, visioning, focusing on the right problems, the issues facing and delivering value as the innovation lab iterates and delivers capabilities and learnings. I want to talk about the role of digital trailblazers. I mean, everybody listening to here is functioning as a digital trailblazer in their organizations in different ways. I could see digital trailblazers having a role interfacing with an innovation lab and what that looks like. I have a question about whether and how to recognize whether you are a digital trailblazer particularly well suited to lead an innovation lab. Some of you are saying it's not the same people who are leading innovation to be able to productionalize innovation. So, you know, Joanne, I'm going to give you a first crack at this. You know, what are some of the roles digital trailblazers can play working with innovation labs? And how do you discern whether you're the right type of mindset, background for a specific type of role, either working with or working in a lab?
Well, I could go to my 5 E's and say they need to be empathetic, they need to be entrepreneurial, they need to be experienced, they need to have expertise, and so forth and so on. And I believe actually the best training ground for a digital trailblazer is to lead an innovation lab. And I tend to recommend to clients that at the same time as they're embarking on their transformative path, whether it's I4, Industry 4, or Industry 5, or smart manufacturing, or, you know, a regenerative business, or digital transformation even, that an innovation lab is a necessity. Because you're not just talking about technology, you're talking about people, about process, and the scope is entirely different than what an innovation lab may be chartered to do. So because it's a bigger scope, I look at a digital trailblazer and say, you could mentor the innovation lab because it gives you the freedom to experiment with all the different aspects of transformation and all the different mindsets around truly becoming a digital business, whether that's tying it to resiliency, tying innovation to employee, you know, how you're benefiting the employee through human-centered design, how you can take something as innocuous as a metric from a shop floor in a plant, OEE, for example, and use that as the bridge between cost efficiency and growth. So to me, the digital trailblazer, if they have the right traits and characteristics and want to be entrepreneurial at all, they should be leading the innovation.
Hey, Roman, I'm hoping Roman will pick up on that. Roman, so what are you looking for in a digital trailblazer who is going to be successful in leading an innovation lab? What are some of the characteristics?
Well, I am probably the wrong model for that one. I spent a lot of time as an IT architect saying no to people on doing things. And it was a shock to me that they asked me to run an innovation lab where I'm suddenly doing all those things I used to say no to. But I would say, you know, obviously all those E's that Joanne is talking about, but really what you want to be able to do is understand your organization, what the goals of this innovation lab or group should be for your organization, and then figure out what's gone wrong in the past and try to address that. I know lots of people feel like if you're talking to somebody who's telling you why it won't work, that they are naysayers. To me, they're the exact people to talk to because I take copious notes on what failed last time. I will tell you, we were on our third, I took over the third iteration of an innovation lab. And it wasn't until I did those things that I think we were successful. But again, you also need to communicate to your stakeholders, and different stakeholders will want different things. And you have to be able to be more than just a, you know, innovative person. You have to be able to also handle different kinds of people, if you will, and what their motives are. Let me give you a short story. We were doing quarterly communications on all the great work we were doing in the lab, and we were doing it for a property and casualty president. And he's watching us talk, and I can see as we're giving these demonstrations of things, he's getting more and more perturbed as we go on. So finally, at the end, I kind of cut it short, and I said, you know, is there anything you would like to know about, anything you'd like to see, what particular is are you focused on? And his big thing was, I don't understand why all these smart people aren't working on my projects that I need, like a, you know, customer relationship management or agency management system. We're having all kinds of trouble in production. You people are brilliant. Why are you not fixing those problems? You know, and, you know, it was a real stunner at that moment. Like, okay, you got a whole different set of priorities.
Roman, it's your answer is so paradoxical to me. I mean, the person saying no with an architect's background that wants to more align, you know, keep the standards and move things at a relatively even pace is now put in front of the innovation lab and is using that mindset as a strength to continue to build on. You know, when I think of the person working in an innovation lab, I'm thinking of someone with design thinking background, right? So really understand customer, really understands how people are working. It's probably my first skill set that I'm looking for. Somebody who's very hands-on with data, because much like to your point, right, the data is going to tell you a story. And sometimes the value has to be experimented on to create that data, then to do the science around it, and then to backfit in and say, hey, is there something here that is particularly valuable that we can create an innovation around? So somebody who's really hands-on with data, you know, when I think about architectural skill sets, I'm thinking about somebody who's really quick at evaluating and trying a technology out, seeing what works, seeing what it's capable of, or maybe what it's not capable of. So a lot of very hands-on skills. You think about the person who is going to go into Azure or go into AWS and have all the services available to you. And now you're going to say, you know, which data environment do I want to use for this particular use case and have 30 different tools to choose from? Mm-hmm. Liz, you left me a good comment here. I'm glad you joined here because the sentiment you left me in the comment is exactly what I was thinking. So much of what makes an innovation lab successful comes back down to very traditional things that PMOs do. So maybe you can comment on that for everybody. You'll have to go off mute, Liz.
Yes, I always have this mute issue, but it's so funny because as I'm listening to this and hearing all these comments about making sure you're clear about what the expectations are around an innovation lab, making sure that we maybe have a charter, making sure that there's good transparency and documentation of learnings and stakeholder engagement. But I'm like, these are all exactly what PMOs do. This is like, so basically all roads lead back to make sure you have a good PMO, but you know, who am I to say? I'm just the PMO whisperer.
I think you're teeing up our next, we have done conversations around PMO and I think we might want to revisit it. I'll work with you on a title, but I mean, it's that also is paradoxical, right? We're hearing Roman talk about the maturity stages of innovation labs. That's also a PMO function. Mm-hmm. We're here talking about what's the right skill set, the right type of people to move in and out of labs? When does the charter change? Because we want to bring some innovation capabilities back into the organization. What types of disruptions we want to focus on? All things that PMOs are really good at, and yet we live in this constant sort of cyclical tempered environment, whether executives like or completely dislike the functions and responsibilities and the cost of having PMOs. So Liz, we're going to have to table this.
For I know. It's like governance is a four-letter word sometimes, you know, because it has such a bad rap.
I don't think this is governance. You know, I look at this as, you know, how we structuring things for success. And I think that's a layer.
But actually, that's what is governance. That's what governance is.
That's right. Oh, that's boy. What it is. I have to agree with her.
Ouch. Throwing the darts at me. All right. I want to have either John or Martin comment on one last question. Digital trailblazers interfacing with labs and what's their role in being able to partner and bring their success into a production environment. I see John is off. What are some things digital trailblazers can do to make labs successful when they're on the outside of it?
Well, we covered the stuff on the beginning, so that, you know, avoid tire kicking on the wrong thing. And then, but these labs, like, they generate like all these learnings and they build all this cool stuff. And so, like, if you have somebody that can then do the next steps to take the learnings and, you know, share it out with the organization and take the code that's built and package it up and put it in repositories. And so people that are really collaborative and really strong at communicating, in my viewpoint, they're the ones that really can, like, take the learnings and everything that's built from those things and then share it out with the rest of the organization. Or if it's in an open source model, like, publish it on the internet for the rest of the world to benefit from it. And so, like, there's two sides of it, like, you know, making sure you're doing the right thing and then sharing it out.
John, I'll probably add one more thing, and that's to present opportunities back to the lab, right? There are going to be some things that the lab is potentially better suited, better funded, better skilled at, you know, and, you know, how do they get value-driven innovations that they can work on? Well, it's got to come from the business units that are already working on things, or at least some of them that are already working on things and saying, look, I need help doing this. Can you help start a POC around or do some experimenting around it? Go ahead, Roman.
One of the things we fostered was an innovation interest group. And in that interest group, we had general meetings. We had a book club. We had like a year-end celebration. We had different, at the end, we even had like startup challenges. We kind of ran an internal incubator or hackathon kind of thing going for the entire corporation. So we just acted as kind of the catalyst for it. But anybody who's interested in innovation can start an interest group within their company. You know, meet quarterly, talk about latest hot technical topics or business topics, etc. Do lunch.
Love it. Lifelong learning qualities of innovation labs. Joanne, give us our last comment for today.
Innovation labs can be transformative in and of themselves to the digital transformer lead and to the digital transformation group. So you might have a completely separate group, but what the innovation lab allows more than anything else, and to Roman's point about capturing the knowledge and John Patrick's point as well, this is the fundamental way to create knowledge management, is take that ideation, take that brainstorming, the trials and travails, document it all, capture it in some way, and then you'd be surprised at how farsighted some of these ideas actually are, where you can go back and revisit them as part of what has become the knowledge base for the organization.
Thank you, everyone, for this lively conversation on leading innovation labs from POC to production. We've covered a lot on organizational model, governance, chartering, visioning, staffing, just a great conversation. I hope all of you listening have taken some good notes. If not, I'm hoping I have a good recording of this one. And as I mentioned, I'm launching the Digital Trailblazer Community version 2.0. That's where I intend to publish recordings that are successful. So if you missed this or want to go back and take some learnings from this, that's where I'll be hosting them. And I have a feeling I can pitch CIO and getting an article around the, you know, the next gen innovation lab, what we have to do differently. So look for that as well. John, Roman, Joanne, Martin, and Liz, thank you for joining me this week. Great conversation. Happy Canada Week for those celebrating in Canada. Happy July 4th for those celebrating in the U.S. Happy close to the Pride Month. It's a Pride Month of, for everybody here. Like I said, June, very exciting things going on. We have our conversation next week on lifelong learning. Fun and growth activities for digital trailblazers. This is going to be a more open-ended conversation about what we're all doing this summer to increase our learning. What are we reading? What are we studying? What courses are we taking? I'm hoping this is an invite for more of you to jump on stage and either share a question about something you want to learn or share an insight about what you're focused on learning this summer. So that will be next week. And I'll be announcing the July and into August coffee hours at next week's newsletter that goes out. You can get to my newsletter at startcio.com/coffee. That will give you access to the community and also access to my newsletter. Again, thank you, everybody. Thanks, Roman, for suggesting today's topic, our resident innovation lab expert. Thank you, Joanne, John, Martin, and Liz for joining us. Everybody, have a good week, and I'll see you next week for sure. Have a good one.